It's always been about stories for Mike Kernan, from listening and reading to writing and telling. Mike spent more than 40 years working in newspapers and TV. After taking early retirement, he threw himself into a passion he'd flirted with through the years and started writing fiction seriously. We discuss the books which mean the most to him, his experience as a self-published author, and his four-year-old grandson, Jimmy. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Very excited. You're a Bookface member and you've also self-published two novels.
I have.
Tell us about your novels and what made you decide to write at this point in your life.
Okay. I actually started writing my first one about 20 years ago, believe it or not. I wrote a short story. It was based on a true incident from my childhood, where two people who weren't close friends, but they were in my kind of circle, Catholic boy, Protestant girl, very much in love, and then the girl's mother made her promise never to marry a Catholic, so off they went their separate ways. And that, to me, was the end of the story as far as I knew. But I think when Friends Reunited started in the early 2000s, I had this idea about this couple meeting again 20-odd years later, and looking at the effect in their life. So I wrote that as a short story, gave it to another writer, and during the course of their conversation, this couple would mention some of their other their mutual friends. So this, I gave it to this other writer to look at. He said, yes, good, Mike, I like it. He said, but where's the backstory? I want to know about these other characters. So I began writing about the other characters, and it grew into this sprawling saga about growing up in a new town, and then the ripple effects of that one conversation. So I did it. I got a little bit of interest from publishers, and as a million would-be authors will tell you, life got in the way. Mm-hmm. So left it, put it aside, and along came COVID. I needed a lockdown project to stop myself going stir-crazy. Decided to revive The Fenian, rewrite it, and that's why I did it, basically.
Amazing. Now, writing has always been a big part of your career, hasn't it? Tell us about what you did for a living before you retired.
Okay, I was a journalist. I think for me, my life has always been about stories. For as long as I can remember, it's been about listening to stories, reading stories, watching stories on television. I became a journalist at the age of 17, and it was a real kind of sink or swim stuff. I got a job in a local paper in an area that I didn't know, where the paper didn't even have an office in the area. And there was me, 17 years old, right out of school, in this town I didn't know, and discovered I wasn't just a reporter of the paper, I was the reporter of the paper.
The only one?
So, yeah, so it was sink or swim. It was basically get down there once a day, catch a bus to Rentrew, as it was, and find enough stories to fill the paper. So that's basically what I've been doing for my whole career. I worked in local papers, evening papers, daily papers, and I did that until 2017. When I then lectured in journalism for a few years and finally retired, allegedly, in 2020.
Of course, you've got a wee grandson. He must keep you busy.
Yes, he does, Jimmy. My wife will be amazed it's taken me this long to mention him. But he's wonderful. And it's funny, I was thinking about how things go full circle. My earliest memories of stories were sitting on my dad's knee being read comics, and now I did it with my own children, and now with Jimmy. He stays with us one night a week. And at story time, there's normally two stories. There's one book. His current favourite book is called The Boy Who Ate Everything, which pretty much does what it says in the tin.
That's me, except I'm the girl.
And then he'll ask one of my stories, and I tell him these stories, some of which have appeared in my books, and I tell him these stories from my childhood. And sometimes if I'm lucky, he'll say, tell me the one about such and such, and that's fine, I can regurgitate that one. But other times his current phrase is, right, big man, what have you got for me? And I've got to make something up. But what I've noticed latterly is that he's a great editor, because he'll say to me, right, big man, tell me the story about the day you locked a monster in the bedroom. So I'll start, and he'll say, no, hang on. Don't bother with all that stuff at the start. Just go straight to the bit where you opened the bedroom door. And I'm thinking, this is great. This is a great lesson for a writer. You know, forget all the flowery build-up. Cut to the chase. So Jimmy's great for that.
That's brilliant. I love that. And how difficult was it publishing The Fenian?
I don't want to sound over-dramatic, But I basically self-published it because I wasn't sure I was going to survive COVID. I've got various health issues. I mean, COVID came along and I rewrote The Fenian, and I contacted two publishers, one of whom replied within 3 days and said, not for us, fair enough. Another one sent me a very nice letter, saying they liked it, they showed a lot of promise, but they were still a bit confused about where they were going because of COVID, so they wouldn't take it on. So I thought to myself, well, you know, things were getting really serious by this point. This was in 2020. We'd been in lockdown, and I thought, if I really want to fulfil this ambition to have a book out there, it's now or never, you know? So my first idea was to maybe find a printer who would do me 50 copies that I would give to friends and family. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing, the kind of Amazon arm of self-publishing. I thought, this is great. This opens a lot of doors. I can get my book out there. It goes straight onto Kindle. You can do it as a paperback on print or demand. So I did it without fantastic expectations. And to my great surprise, it took off. The response to it was incredible. And still is. I'm still amazed that 3.5 years on, someone somewhere buys it every day. And I think, who are you? Where are you?
I want to hug you. Yeah. That's brilliant. And what about your second book? What made you decide to do the second book?
Well, I wrote The Fenian very much as a one-off, because I've got about 5 novels in mind, 2 of which are completely written, or the first draft is written, 2 of which I've about half written. So I decided this is it. One story about my upbringing, about my background. But it was really the response from readers that bowled me over. And I was blindsided by it. This was something I just didn't expect. I never in my life have thought to contact an author and say, this is what your book meant to me. But I was overwhelmed with the response. People messaging me saying, you've told a story of my life. How did you know this? Or wow, you've written our history. And so, but what happens next? That's what they kept saying. What happens? So I thought, well, is there another book in this? And I made what in retrospect was a kind of rookie mistake with The Fenian, because I had an epilogue in which I summed up the lives of all the characters, where they were now, what happened to them. I thought, so where do I go with this? Mm-hmm. I call Stopping to Rain the accidental sequel, because there was a scene towards the end of The Fenian where 2 of the main characters return to their stomping ground. They go back to an old shelter where they used to hang out, and they find it's been invaded by a bunch of younger kids, including some siblings and some friends of theirs. And the whole point of that scene was just about the passing on of the baton. You know, when we're teenagers, we think, this is the most important thing in the world, you know, our little dramas, where in reality, it's a small snapshot of your life, and there's always another generation coming up behind you. So I thought, that's the cast of the next story, because it reflects real life. It also gives me the opportunity to move a narrative on a few years, so I can bring in more popular culture, more events in the time in the background. So that's what. So I remember one day going for a walk along Largs Seafront where I live, and basically working out the beginning and the end of the story. And I thought, yeah, there's plenty here. There's more, so much more material. So that's where the Stopping to Rain came from.
Brilliant, brilliant. And, you know, what have you learned about yourself through writing these novels, do you think?
I think I've learned that I wish I'd done it 30 years ago or 40 years ago, really. Right. So, and I feel now that I'm making up for lost time. But there's always, you can't be too selfish about it. You know, I've got my wife, we love to go travelling. We love to do things together. I've got my grandchildren, I've got my children. So I can't go and work at it as much as I would like to, 5, 6, 7 days a week. So it's a case now of just grabbing time when I can. And I absolutely love it. It's such a passion for me now.
Yeah. I can feel that. I mean, I know that from you because you're in Bookface and, you know, and you come to all the events and, you know, you can see that you really get a huge kick out of this.
I do, and I love listening to authors. I think one of the downsides of self-publishing, there are a lot of downsides of self-publishing, but one is about your own self-esteem. You know, I come to the Bookfest events and I love listening to other authors. They talk about their processes and I recognise things. I think it was Chris Brookmeyer who talked about writing as he walked, and I do that every day. I write things, I speak into my phone and record little conversations. But I look at guys like Chris Brookmeyer and John Niven and others, Karen Campbell, who wrote Paper Cup, and I think, nah, I'm not in that club. I'm just doing it at my own little level. So you think that, but then you think, but does that really matter? You know, the whole, my aim is not that, I'm not ever going to give J.K. Rowling or Richard Osman sleepless nights. You know, my aim, I think I've got stories to tell and I want people to read them. And if it's 10 people or 50 people or 500 people, so be it. The whole point is I want to get my stories out there.
Absolutely. And you're doing brilliantly. I mean, I see the reviews in Bookface. I see your Amazon reviews. You know, you're smashing it. So well done.
Thank you. Thank you.
Angling is also a big hobby, isn't it?
Yes. My angling, my actual fishing has been a bit restricted in the last couple of years because of health issues. But I still write about it. I started writing a fishing column for the Scottish Sun, where I worked for many years. I started that column in 2008, really for two reasons. First of all, because I felt angling deserved a platform of some kind. It's a massively popular sport, but it's not a spectator sport. There are no big stars. You know, people don't kind of go to watch fishing. So it's never going to become a kind of massively popular sport in terms of media coverage. But I felt it does deserve a platform. But also for me, I worked on the back bench of a newspaper where it was pressured all the time. It was you're trying to hit deadlines, you're trying to beat your rivals, you're trying to juggle so many balls. So the fishing column for me was a bit of a release, a bit of an escape, a bit of a, pardon the pun, a little kind of backwater where I could go and write about my passion. So yeah, I still do that.
Great. And one of your favourite books on the sport is by an American author.
Yes, John Gierach he's called. And he's written, he's been writing books for about 40 years and somehow manages to find new things to say on every page almost. At times when you read John Gierach, he's very lyrical. It kind of doesn't matter if it's about fishing, it's about life really, but told through the kind of prism of fishing. Fantastic writer.
It's funny, it's not a genre that I would ever pick up, but I know what you mean. Some people have this uncanny knack of being able to write so beautifully that it doesn't really matter if you're not exactly into the subject.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Any plans for you to write a book on angling?
I have written a book on angling. I brought a book out on fishing in 2020. That was my second lockdown project, and it was called Fishing in the Sun, predictably, because that's where I worked. But the last thing I wanted to do was to write a how-to book. For one thing, there are people much, much more qualified than me to write about how to fish and how to catch fish. And there are so many of them out there. So I wanted to write a book just about my own experiences, the people I'd met, the places I'd been, kind of inspired by John Gierach to write about my life in fishing. And it was great fun. There were some fantastic stories. I remember one story that never left me. When somebody said to me, what was your most frightening experience in fishing? Because I've been out ice fishing and seen someone collapse falling through ice. I've been, I escaped a fire in the Faroes. But the most frightening experience of my fishing life was caused by a four-year-old girl. I was fishing at the River Gryfe in Renfrewshire. Caught trout, and this girl was fishing with her dad along the bank. She came over to me and said, can I see your fish? And I said, yeah, not a problem. Can I touch your fish? And I said, yeah, fine, okay. And then she turned kind of scary-eyed and said to me, and how did you dead it? And I said, I tried not to be too graphic. I said, well, we have this little object called a priest and you tap the fish in the head and that's how you do it. And she said, okay. Do you think you could hit it again really, really hard so I can see its blood? Oh, and I looked at her. And she walked away and I could hear the music from The Exorcist. And
oh my gosh.
So it's really tales about the people I've met, the experiences I've had in fishing.
It's a
fishing.
Very peaceful hobby, isn't it?
Yes, it is, very much, very much. To me, when I was working, my day off was Friday, was a Friday, and I always went fishing on a Friday. No matter what, I would go fishing on a Friday. And it was the escape from all the pressures and the strains, because when you fish, nothing else matters, not the past, not the future, not your mortgage, not your family, nothing matters other than that 3 or 4 or 5 hours when you're concentrating on nothing more than trying to fool a fish into thinking your little bit of fluff is a real insect. And it's beautiful.
Great to have a hobby that you're passionate about.
Very much. Very
love
much.
That. So in terms of, you know, what you read when you're not fishing or playing with Jimmy or going on holiday with your wife and, you know, child minding and things, what's your kind of like go-to favourite genre? Do you have one?
I think I kind of class it more as kind of people stuff. I like reading about people. I'll read almost anything. There are a few genres that I'm not particularly keen on. I'm not a big fan of cosy crime. I'm not a big fan of fantasy or speculative fiction, Game of Thrones, that kind of thing. But I'll read anything where the characters grab me, where I feel engaged with the characters. And, you know, I also am very much into the kind of drama in ordinary lives. So Michael Vanney, Irvine Welsh, more recently things like The Heart's Invisible Furies, these kind of books where it's about ordinary people.
You mentioned Irvine Welsh. I've never read Irvine Welsh.
I know, I've heard that a few times and it baffles me. I think his early stuff was very, very good. I mean, when I first heard read Trainspotting, it had such a massive impact on me that I kind of thought nothing written before really matters.
Yeah.
Now, I kind of came down from that pedestal at some point.
Yeah.
But that's how I felt. It was really about a part of life that had been ignored, but where there is as much drama as anywhere else.
I mean, it certainly was a transformative novel when it first came out, and obviously the films, I absolutely loved the films. Yeah. I thought they were beautifully done. And you mentioned The Heart's Invisible Furies. Now, that is the book that I probably have bought the most for people. How did you come across that book?
I think it was a recommendation on Bookface. Someone else mentioned it, and I remember reading the opening lines and thinking to myself, if you can read these opening lines and not be compelled to read on, then you don't have a heart, you know. you have a heart of stone, because it's so beautiful and so compelling. I love the way, to me it's almost like a collection of short novels, because you dip into the character's life every 7 years, and it's like starting afresh, wondering where he's been, what's happened to him, where he is. It's just that. And I can tend to judge novels on three categories: the quality of writing, the plotting, and the characters. And there are books that get away with one out of three and still be quite successful. But The Heart's Invisible Furies is just superb in every one of these categories. It's just a fantastic book.
I completely agree. I've never really read anything like that before.
Me too.
You know, that made me laugh, made me cry, you know, really had such an impact. Cyril and his, you know, 70 years of his life. Quite something to be able to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, there's one of the characters who says something like, "That's not my standard at all." And I used that as my catchphrase for a long time till my wife was almost going to kill me.
"That's not my standard at all."
"That's not my standard at all."
That's brilliant. And you mentioned Michael Vanney. I must admit, I've not read any Michael Vanney. Sort of Scottish crime isn't really my bag, although one of the things that I love about being in our great book group is that I'm trying different genres.
Right.
And like you, I'm not into sci-fi or fantasy, or even, I mean, I've never read Stephen King. You know, I will do.
I haven't either.
Have you not?
Never. No.
Wow.
No.
Wow. So it's funny that, isn't it? So tell me about Michael Vanney.
Michael Vanney, I must tell you my story about Michael Vanney. William Michael Vanney was responsible for my last deliberate criminal act. I applied for a job as editor of the Galloway Gazette down in Newton Stewart many years ago, the end of the 1980s. And I stayed in Newton Stewart overnight in a B&B because I lived in England at the time. It was a long drive back. And I wanted to check out the house market and stuff while I was there. So there wasn't, as it turned out, there wasn't a lot to do in Newton Stewart on a November Tuesday night. So I found this copy of Doherty by Michael Vanney in a bookcase in the bed and breakfast, and I was just mesmerised by it. It's not a crime book. It's about it's set in a I think it's Ayrshire, a mining community at the turn of the century, 1903, 1904. So I was mesmerised by this book. Sat up half a night reading it. So in the morning, I thought, I have to finish this book. So I stole it. Mm-hmm. I stole it from the bed and breakfast so I could stop on the way back and drive home. So I finished the book on the way home. Fast forward about 14 years, and my daughter was doing a postgrad in journalism at Glasgow University. And one of their assignments was to interview someone famous. And I think Michael Vanney, around about that time, had just been given an honorary doctorate or something, or won some kind of award. So my daughter got in touch with his agent, and he agreed to be interviewed by my student daughter. So unknown to me, she took along that copy of Doherty and told him that story. So he put a little inscription in it, and it remains one of my most treasured possessions. It starts off, "Dear Michael, I do admire a cultured thief. Your crime flatters me, Willie M." And wow. That is fantastic. And I will never part with that.
That's amazing. What a guy. Yeah. So cool.
But he was part of, you know, my interest in books about ordinary, like the drama in ordinary lives. And he was very much about that. You know, his books, like the Doherty in particular, is just fantastic. I would say if you're going to start with Michael Vanney, that's a place to start.
Noted. Thank you. Is your wife a big reader?
She is, yes. We tend to, there are very few books that we both like. She likes Peter May, but the most recent one that she had a bit of a kind of lull for about a year, where she found it hard to get into anything. And then I got her a copy of Brodie by Gillian Sheriffs, and she absolutely loved it. In fact, I messaged Gillian, said to her, "You've got my wife back into reading. She's loved it so much."
Great. Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, Gillian's quite special.
Yes, very much.
Her story's quite special. And I know that I loved the review of Brodie that you shared in Bookface, because you kind of started off by saying, I didn't think I was going to like this.
No, I decided I wasn't going to like it. I actually met Gillian at one of the Bookface events, and she mentioned the book, and my daughter was had come to that one, and she got it, then I got it, and I just thought it was fantastic. I thought it was so good. Again, my old thing about the drama and ordinary life, it was very much about that.
Yeah.
And I liked the fact that she took risks in that book too, because not everything had a nice and neat ending. You were left kind of, but that is like life. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And just a funny anecdote that I've just remembered. There's a hairdresser's that I go to in Glasgow locally, and I'm always talking about books, obviously. And there was a lady, Tracy, was in having her hair done, and we got chatting about books, and I invited her to a Bookface event. She couldn't come. But anyway, she recently met you and or your daughter and your wife on a train going to Edinburgh.
Yes, she met my daughter and my wife.
She bought two of your books. Yeah. Tracy Thompson's her name. So
that's my sales force.
So weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's amazing. So have you got any plans to be releasing any books this year?
I'm working on if Stopping to Rain was the accidental sequel to The Fenian, then the next one is the accidental third book and I think final book in the trilogy about... The books are set in Cumbernauld when I grew up, although I call it Cumbride in the books. And I'm often asked why I don't use Cumbernauld, why I changed it. And the reason is that I don't have to tell the truth, so I don't have to be accurate.
You know? Okay.
I try to capture the flavour of the place, but I don't want to be tied to geography. If someone says, oh, you can't... In fact, that the town centre didn't open until 1967, but you've got it open in 65. But I said, it's just fiction. It's fiction. So anyway, I'm writing a third one. And again, it's kind of accidental because in both The Fenian and Stopping to Rain, I tried to give all of the characters a backstory. And there were two of the characters in Stopping to Rain whose backstory began growing and growing and growing. And I thought, this is threatening to overwhelm the plot. But I kept going with it because I thought, this is a good story. And at one point, I did a word count on this backstory, and it was like 70,000 words. And I thought, I can't bear to cut it down. I can't bear to cut it because it's such a powerful story. So I think, right, okay, that's the next book. I take that out of Stopping to Rain, and that's going to be the next one, and I think the last one. And the working title is Mad Gravy. I think it's very powerful. It's more focused on two of the characters rather than the whole gang. But yeah, I love it.
What's been the best thing, do you think, about embarking on this path as a novelist?
The single best thing. Can I give you two answers to this?
Yeah, of course.
The first one is discovering the magic keyboard. Is sitting down with an idea for a chapter or a scene and thinking, have I got enough material for this chapter? And the next thing you know, you've had to split it into like five chapters because there's so much there. And I think, I don't know where this is coming from, because I just sit down and off it goes. And I remember the American author James Lee Burke talked about that when someone asked him where his stories came from, and he said, I have no idea. He said, they're nothing to do with me. I sit down and they appear. And that's kind of like what happens with me, and it's a magical feeling. But the second bonus is something I touched on before. It's the response from readers, the contact from readers. I didn't expect that, and also the contact from old friends that I hadn't seen for 50 years, who I'm now back in touch with, who read the book, and they come from all walks of life. Of one guy who was the former chief executive of Dyson, who is the same birthday as me, who I grew up with. We have been now back in touch, and that to me has been the biggest bonus, is the response from people.
Books are magic, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Do you think wee Jimmy knows that you're a published author?
Well, he does know. He knows for two reasons. First of all, because I've told him, and I've actually shown him the books, and also because his dad, who's a graphic designer, Ryan, my son-in-law, designed the covers. So he knows that his dad did that part. And just to expose myself as being an old softie, okay? I have got a copy of The Fenian that my daughter has put away, and inside it there is a picture of me holding Jimmy on the day he was born.
Oh.
And I put a little note saying, my arms are round you on the day you were born, and they will always be around you. Oh. And I've left that so that one day, hopefully, when he's 16 or 18 or 20, he'll pick it up and think, what is this thing? Did people actually cut down trees? And
oh, that is so lovely. I love that. Like, Kiernan, thank you so much. That was brilliant.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please take 30 seconds to rate, review and subscribe. It really helps. New episodes drop every Thursday. Thanks so much for listening.